Welcome to the Lemper Report Live. Today is a remarkable food holiday. It's Cesar Chavez Day, a remarkable farm worker, labor leader, and civil rights activist who co-founded what today we know of as the United Farm Workers Union. To quote President Obama, who declared the national holiday, Chavez left a legacy as an educator, environmentalist, and a civil rights leader, and his cause lives on as farm workers and laborers across America continue to struggle for fair treatment and fair wages. We find strength in what he accomplished so many years ago, and we should honor him for what he's taught us about making America a stronger, more just, and more prosperous nation. Cesar Chavez, all of us in the food world, thank you, and we honor you. Today, I have to just shake my head at what I'll call lame supermarket ratings that continue to be meaningless. Grubhub gets sued. Applebee's wants a facelift, but maybe they need a food lift? Why flexitarianism is the diet to watch today and in the future. The Mediterranean diet gets even better. Slim Jim joins the metaverse. You can't blame that cow anymore for climate change. And breaking the myths on food processing. One programming note, there will not be a Lemper Report Live next week due to the RDBA virtual experience, which begins on Tuesday, April 5th. We will be back here same time on Monday, April 11th. Sally, let's start the week by talking about supermarket ratings.
Hi, Phil. For the second year in a row, the Fresh Market has topped USA Today's best supermarkets in America list. And it's a really interesting list because about half of them are small format stores.
So I'm not going to take issue with the winners. Fresh Market, Hy-Vee, Aldi, Lidl, Stu Leonard's, Market Basket, Publix, Wegmans, Trader Joe's, PCC, Community Markets. What I will take issue with are two things. Number one, this sort of looks to me like a scam. And I like USA Today a lot. But number one is they sell a license. Once you win one of these 10 supermarkets, they sell a license that you can use their logo. That's number one. Number two is the people who pick these, and they say that they have consumers who actually vote on them, but nowhere could I find online any voting taking place and things like that. But what the judges that they assemble are lame. These are not supermarket people. They have Catherine Smith, who's the Reader's Choice Awards production manager and social media director for USA Today. Deanie Sanderson, who is the creator of Napa Food Gal Travels, a food, wine, and travel journalist and digital influencer. Kyle McCarthy, Family Travel Forum. Marla Simini, an award-winning writer with passion for travel, music, surfing, and culinary adventures, and Robert Niles, the founder and editor of Theme Park Insider. None of these are supermarket people. You know, I just find it to be lame. And Consumer Reports, I've always taken issue with their ratings because, again, what the problem is, when these ratings come out, there is no one national supermarket chain. You could argue that Walmart is. But when you start putting the Fresh Market against Raley's, against other regional chains, it just doesn't make sense for a national publication, a national logo.
Yeah, or can we have two categories? You know, we can have our small format category and our large store category. But, you know, I think ultimately, like, you know, that we want to see, I agree with you, more industry people on the panels, but also just consumers voting.
Yeah, I mean, this is not transparent at all. So USA Today, shame on you. And, you know, I hope you make a lot of money licensing your logo. But, you know, as far as the value of it, and again, not to take anything away from these stores, these are all good stores, but it's lame how they got to be. Mm-hmm. So another lawsuit. Grubhub is now being sued by the District of Columbia. What's going on?
Yes, they're being accused of deceptive trade practices. And apparently, Grubhub is listing more than 1,000 partner restaurants available for delivery in their app, but they don't have contracts with these restaurants. And so what's happening is that they're posting out-of-date menu prices. There are typically higher prices for the people that are ordering. So there's a lot of gray area there in what's going on and how this third-party platform is operating.
Yeah, and those 1,000 restaurants you named, that's just in Washington, D.C., mm-hmm. you know. They don't have these deals. It's amazing to me. And also, the other thing that the suit says, that consumers have to pay various fees, such as delivery fee, service fee, and a small order fee for purchases under $10, which just keeps getting that price up and up and up. This isn't the first time we've seen it. Chicago has done the same thing. San Francisco, there's a lawsuit against them. All these delivery services are really going to come under a lot of scrutiny, I think, over the next few months as we are going back to somewhat normal and less reliant on delivery as the pandemic eases up. So Applebee's, there's this great story in Eater written by Amy McCarthy. Amy actually worked at Applebee's for a brief time as a hostess. So she's able to give us a look behind the scenes, talk about the fact that, you know, all their foods are microwaved. They have announced that they're going to add drive-through windows to 15 locations. They've got over 1,600 locations now. So the fact that they're, you know, 15 locations from a drive-through. But really what she's talking about is the problem with Applebee's is the quality of the food. But Applebee's now has some hipness to it.
Well, I don't know if you're familiar, if you listen to mainstream pop country, but there was a song this past year that it was a smash hit by Walker Hayes called Fancy Like. And the gist of it is that, you know, the first verse he talks about how, you know, his girl's not fancy and he takes her to Wendy's and she likes to get her fries there. But when he, you know, when they get fancy, they go to Applebee's. And it very much plays like an Applebee's commercial, as if he was writing an Applebee's commercial. But I think we have to consider, you know, what our younger generations are telling us. And, you know, particularly we talk about millennials a lot and what they want. And that chain food isn't really cutting it for them.
And is it the food itself? Is it the atmosphere? I mean, one of the things... And I've been to Applebee's before, not a regular Applebee's guy. But I mean, all these chain restaurants look the same on the inside, and they're all kind of ugly.
Yeah, I think that is definitely part of the problem is that there is no character or personality to these establishments, but also the food, you know, the interest in better quality food has been increasing, especially with the younger generation. And, you know, as the woman who worked at Applebee's that wrote this article is talking about, you know, that they use a microwave to make food at Applebee's.
Yeah.
So...
Oh, well, and I think that, you know, they haven't kept up. In fact, there's a new study that came out that has found that over half of young Americans describe themselves as flexitarian. And I don't know how many flexitarian dishes there are at Applebee's, number one. But let's talk about this study. 71% of Americans dabble in plant-based. And what we're seeing, obviously, we've seen it in fast food, KFC, Burger King, Starbucks, McDonald's. They all have now some kind of plant-based burger. And, you know, when we look at the flexitarian diet, I think, and we've talked about this before, that to me is the future, that it's not either extreme. It's not just people going for plant-based everything. We're going to get to that in a second when we talk about the Mediterranean diet or just being an omnivore. So I think that people are looking for more of a balance. And again, with this study, which were age 24 to 39 year olds, flexitarianism is a real thing.
Yes, it really is. The study says 47% describe themselves as a flexitarian and that 63% would be willing to swap meat for a plant-based alternative if it met a certain criteria. Now, we're talking about, you know, that we'll eat faux meat, but we want it to taste really good. So that's why a lot of these companies are working really hard to create products that that meet that, you know, the taste needs of people who are eating meat. But it is an interesting thing to see. I think the younger generation is more concerned about the planet and how we eat for a better planet. I think they're more concerned about what they put in their bodies. And so it's something that, you know, supermarkets and the entire food industry will have to follow.
See, for me, and if we look at Beyond Meat, for example, last week, they lost 40% of their value, you know, in their stock price. I think the number was 40%. And, you know, I still go back to, you know, one of my favorite things was the blend that the Mushroom Council worked on with the James Beard Foundation, 50% mushrooms, 50% ground beef, you know, I actually think it tastes better than it when it's 100% ground beef because of the umami flavor and so on. So, you know, flexitarianism is a real thing and it's going to continue. But there's a study that, and we all know the benefits of the Mediterranean diet, but there's a new study that's come out that says even there's a greener Mediterranean diet, which eliminates all meat and provides even extra greens, and the health benefits are enormous by doing that.
Yes, this study really shows, you know, like you said, we've already seen for years and years, research has shown us that told us that the Mediterranean diet was one of the best diets that you could follow out there. And that diet includes a lot of vegetables and nuts and seeds and a little bit of seafood and a little bit of meat. This alternative, the green Mediterranean diet, just takes the meat out completely. So this is a eating better for your body, but also eating better for the planet. And whether or not you are planning on going, you know, completely vegetarian or vegan, there are some takeaways from the study to learn about becoming eating more plant-based. And some of the things that I saw, you know, in this study that were most interesting to me is about brain atrophy. This study showed that in subjects 50 years or old, both med diets were associated with significantly reduced shrinkage of the hippocampus, which is the part of our brain that helps us with our memory.
What? What? I guess I have to worry about that once I'm over 50. Uh-huh. But no, I think the study is really good, really worth a look. One question I have, and I'm not able to figure this out, and I've looked a number of times in the study, what they also are doing is including walnuts in the diet. And I was searching to see whether or not the Walnut Council or California Walnuts or somebody was funding this study. I couldn't find it out. But walnuts are a great healthy way, any nuts to add to your diet, whether it's almonds, which are rich in calcium, and fruits and nuts and vegetables important in all of our diets. And talking about nuts, Slim Jim has decided to join the metaverse. Of course they did.
Well, they had to because they just had that name right there in front of them, the Metaverse, which they have now filed a trademark for, the Metaverse, Slim Jim, and Longboy Gang also. And they are looking to bring some virtual goods and virtual products and NFTs to the Metaverse.
Yep. I guess everybody's going to be in the metaverse. And Sean Connolly, who's the CEO of ConAgra, ConAgra owns Slim Jim, you know, went out there and he said, yeah, we're going to do some really cool things with Slim Jim and our other brands in the metaverse. So it'll be interesting to see what happens. He says that they're going to allow people to browse. I don't know, browsing in a Slim Jim store, what that means, accumulate, buy, and sell, trade virtual food products. So I guess I could buy a virtual Slim Jim and not have to eat it.
There you go.
And now it's time for the Lemper Report. Regenerative grazing practices are all the buzz these days, but the truth is what initiated these practices was not about climate or sequestering carbon. It was about farmers working hard to keep their farms profitable. When Gabe Brown first got into regenerative agriculture more than 25 years ago, he wasn't trying to solve climate change. I was just trying to keep the banker at bay and feed my family, he told CNBC. He grew up in North Dakota and studied to be an ag professor. His wife's family had a farm, so the newlyweds moved home to help on the farm, which used conventional farming practices for the time. 27 years ago, 1995 through 1998, Brown's farm in North Dakota faced recurrent natural disasters. 3 years of hail, a year of drought. Brown needed to figure out how to make his land profitable. Also, he didn't have the money to spend on fertilizer or chemicals. It took me on a learning path, and I really became a student of nature and of ecosystems and how to natural ecosystems function, he told CNBC. Today, Brown runs his 6,000-acre ranch near Bismarck, North Dakota, with regenerative practices and helps run a consulting company, Understanding Ag, which consults with farmers managing 32 million acres across North America. Regenerative cattle grazing is a way of sequestering carbon dioxide, he says, a critical component of limiting global warming. Cattle who graze on the land eat plants that have absorbed carbon dioxide from the air. After grazing, the cows don't graze the land for a long time, giving the roots a chance to grow another layer of leaves, capturing even more carbon. The amount of carbon sequestered with regenerative grazing practices varies significantly, depending on how well a farmer is grazing the cattle and how diverse the plant species are in the land that's being grazed. The range is from 2.5 to 7.5 metric tons of carbon per acre per year, according to Brown's partner in Understanding Ag, Alan Williams. To combat climate change, we must turn to our farmers and ranchers to lead the way. And the good news is, they are. On Lost in the Supermarket, I spoke with Eric Decker, PhD professor, Department of Food Science, College of Natural Sciences at the University of Massachusetts at Amherst, about the truth about food processing. He's listed as one of the most highly cited scientists in agriculture. For the full episode, just log on to supermarketguru.com, click on the Lost in the Supermarket icon. Here's a preview of what he had to say. So first off, let's get some definitions here. What is food processing and how is food processing different from processed food?
So food processing is really any changes that happen to the food once they leave the farm. So it could be as simple as peeling something or chopping something. And food processing that's done in factories, many times it's not really different than what we when we cook our food at home. So processing includes all different kinds of things that we do at home, like when we cook our vegetables or we cook our meat. And these same, what we call unit operations in the industry, are done in factories, but they're just done on a much larger scale. And many times they're much more efficient than what we can do at home. So they're actually more sustainable than our home cooking operations.
On today's Bullseye, let's talk about cryptocurrency. With all the news about Ukraine and Russia, a Supreme Court nominee, and the apparent conflicts emerging about a different Supreme Court justice, you might have missed what happened last Wednesday. President Biden signed an executive order to examine the risks and benefits of cryptocurrencies. The focus is on six key areas: consumer protection, financial stability, illicit activity, U.S. competitiveness, financial inclusion, and responsible innovation. Another aspect of the order is to explore a digital version of the U.S. dollar. Now, this is an important step in determining the future of NFTs and the metaverse. BlockFi was fined $50 million by the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission earlier this year over violating SEC laws with its retail lending product. Other crypto firms are also facing scrutiny from the SEC. China has already banned cryptocurrencies, as has Algeria, Bangladesh, Qatar, Turkey, Egypt, Morocco, and yes, even Russia, more than 40 countries in all. The reality is that just writing out a check, putting it in an envelope, placing a stamp in that upper right-hand corner, and finding a mailbox, if you can, to send it, just doesn't work anymore. Even when I go to pay a bill through my bank, there's a disclaimer that says using the post office to deliver their checks that they produce may take 5 to 7 days. Wouldn't I rather use Zelle or Venmo? As we witness the evolution of the metaverse, there's no question that there will be some type of electronic payment system needed, one that's easy, safe, and doesn't take the energy to create it like it does for Bitcoin. Bitcoin is a decentralized digital currency without a central bank or single administrator that can be transferred from user to user on the Bitcoin network without the need for intermediaries. Bitcoin's estimated power consumption in early 2022 was 138 terawatt hours. That's more than the country of Norway. DigiEconomist estimates that the Bitcoin network is responsible for about 114 million tons of carbon dioxide per year. Why does this cryptocurrency require so much energy? Well, it's from the tens of thousands of computers that are used to verify transactions. It's estimated that a single Bitcoin transaction uses 2,292.5 kilowatt hours of electricity. Now, that's the equivalent of powering a typical U.S. home for 78 days. To be fair, the banking industry consumes over double that amount of energy. For the metaverse to reach its true opportunity, we're going to have to figure out digital currency, and soon. Don't forget to join us on supermarketguru.com. Don't forget that next Monday's show, we're going to be on hiatus, getting ready for the Retail Dietitians Business Alliance virtual experience, and we'll be back here a week from next Monday. Have a great 2 weeks.